Okay, so I'm Deborah Kresniansky, and on behalf of the Crown Heights Jewish Community Council, Adi Aaron Shalom Task Force, I'm welcoming you to this important phone call, how you can help a loved one in an abusive marriage. This is a dynamic partnership of organizations with goals to really make a dent in the areas of domestic abuse in the Crown Heights community and beyond. The Crown Heights Community Council deals with matters of concern to the Jewish community of Crown Heights. Azayad programs provide the necessary tools and insights for a strong and successful marriage, starting with pre-shidduchim through the shidduch process and into the marriage itself. And Shalom Task Force aims to help women and families struggling with troubled relationships at home. Tonight's call is a part of a series of workshops and education organized by the Crown Heights Jewish Community Council under a grant by the New York City Council Domestic Violence Initiative, awarded the Crown Heights Community Council by Council Member Matthew Eugene. Tonight's call is coming at domestic abuse from the angle of providing resources for those who are helping a loved one in an abusive marriage, whether it's a man or a woman, and that both men and women might be victims of abuse. This is the first of many different workshops and education that we'll have this year. So if you have any insights, questions, suggestions, please email us at info@adayad.org, or you can always use the anonymous, send an anonymous question or comment at adayad.org/ask-anonymous-question. Tonight, Lisa Tversky will talk with Nechama and Yisrael as they try to help their sister Rivki through her ordeal. Lisa Tversky is on the board of directors of Nefesh International. She maintains a private practice in Brooklyn and lectures locally and nationally and internationally on domestic abuse, marriage, and dating. And she has this great book, I'm So Confused by Being Abused. It's an important read for people who are trying to be helpful. We're also grateful to Nechama and Yisrael for taking their family's pain and being part of bringing support and healing to others. And through this call and before and even after, you could send us questions for the Q&A later, and we can also try to address other questions at other points. You can send the questions to info@adayad, and I'll check that throughout the call, and or you can send your questions to adayad.org/ask-anonymous-question. So, our next event is on February 20th, which is for not yet married young women. Awakening Your Intuition with Esther Russell, How to Trust Your Gut and Let It Talk to You from the Lens of Dating and Marriage. So look out for the posting about that in the next few days. And now, thank you, Lisa, Yisrael, and Nechama for sharing on this call, and I pass the microphone to you guys.
Hi, everybody. Okay, this is Lisa Tversky, and tonight we're going to be, as Deborah said, talking about how you can help a loved one in an abusive marriage. And we're going to start by talking a little bit, or not just start, but sort of pepper in with my more didactic information, the situation that two siblings found themselves in with their sister. So I guess I want to start with the two of you, if you could start us off. We're not going to be getting into particulars. We're going to be, maybe we'll talk a little bit about how you can know what the actual situation is or when you have questions about the situation. But this was a situation where there was some clarity about the fact that there was abuse going on. And I thought we could start by having you give us a little bit of how you started to become aware of issues, when you started worrying, and go from there for me to talk about how siblings can start, what are the pitfalls, can start to respond, what do you want to watch out for, what do you want to do, what do you not want to do. So if the two of you could start us off with, how did it begin for you?
Okay, I'll go first. Nechama, if that's okay.
That works.
Okay, so I think in the beginning, maybe there were signs that it wasn't necessarily the happiest marriage, but mm-hmm. it definitely wasn't anything that we thought of abuse, and definitely at that point I was very ignorant about the whole concept. And if it ever came up, if if you know, we'd ask my sister how it's going, she would always downplay it. Maybe something wasn't great, but it's okay, or it's okay now, and it's getting better.
Mm.
So, and this went on, you know, for a good, for more than a few years, when we only found out afterwards that there were things even then that were going on that were abusive.
Right.
How I became aware of it, I think the maybe the frequency of incidents increased, but also the biggest one was where someone had witnessed an incident, and we realized that the versions of the story that she was saying wasn't really what was going on. That there was a lot more. That basically we were able to see firsthand that she was downplaying, and things were a lot worse than she was making out to be.
So you had an inkling that things weren't happy. You kind of checked in. She reassured you, but then somebody witnessed something that you had heard from her one version where you might have left it alone, but then came to find out there was a much worse version that was reality, and that made you start to question the whole picture.
Exactly.
Of how bad things really were.
Exactly. And then you started to hear a lot more.
Uh-huh. And you started to hear a lot more from whom?
Even from her at that point, like I guess once the cat was out of the bag, so to speak, that it had been witnessed. So it was like, okay, yeah, well, this has happened before, these kind of incidents, and it's not so good.
Right. So, you know, I kind of want to ask you two, but I also want to make the comment that this is sort of a crucial moment. When there's all of this disturbing information, and how do you respond? Do you underplay because you don't want to scare them, or you don't want to, you know, meddle too much, or you don't want to be responsible for the breakup of a marriage? Do you overjump into the situation and start telling the sibling, brother or sister, you got to do this, you got to do that, you got to get out, you got to go here, you got to go there? You know, it's a very difficult place to navigate. And so I guess I want to hear, before I talk about, you know, the advice, how did you guys navigate that? You finally kind of get this shock of cold water in your face that things are worse than you thought. And where did you go with that? What did you do with that?
So it definitely was a cold water in the face. And we were definitely, we didn't know. We really didn't know what to do at first.
Right. And so then what? How did it get moving?
I can interject.
Yeah.
Okay. So like my brother said, we did, you know, there were things that we felt the whole time. There was something that was uncomfortable about the relationship from the beginning, but nothing that we could pinpoint. And at that point, you know, in the beginning when things just seemed different or things were not okay, we helped as much as we could for that couple to go to therapy and all the different things that we thought were going to be beneficial. When
mm-hmm.
this incident took place, this was already after years of marriage, and the two of them, they have children.
Right.
And this incident actually took place with one of the children.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, we just got really, really nervous because we said, you know, it's one thing for us to say she has her journey and she has to figure it out and we can try to help her, but we can't push her. But how can we, you know, put that on the kids?
Right.
So we were really, really struck at that point. And we knew we had to do something. We had a lot of discussions about what we should do.
Mm-hmm.
It did get to one point when all the stories were coming up where, you know, we were kind of thinking, do we need to give her an ultimatum? You know,
mm-hmm.
you can choose what you're going to do, but we're going to take care of the kids. That was one of the thoughts that came up. But we didn't know is our place to say, what isn't. There are more siblings who kind of each came at a different angle, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So she definitely was getting a lot of different kinds of messages from different siblings, depending on their placement in the family and how close they were to her.
Right.
But at this point, we started to push to say that this is a bigger issue than what counseling can help you with. You don't belong with this person.
Mm.
So specifically we did is, I guess, we started talking between ourselves. We were, I guess, phone conferences, but, you know, we got to figure out, we got to do something. And, you know, like Nahama said, until then it was, okay, you got to figure it out. We'll try to give you our opinion here and there, but, like, more, we got to be more involved. And
right.
And when we did push to say, you know, this is not acceptable, and
mm-hmm.
we got to think what we're going to do here, there was, you know, the resistance from her. She wanted to work things out. She wanted to see if there was a path that we can, if there were still options to try, she wanted to do it. And,
right.
and as
right.
I went on, there was definitely a frustration where, you know, why can't you see that you shouldn't be there?
Right. And that's the tension, you know, that a lot of family members face. It's a few things. First of all, do we give an ultimatum? How do we give an ultimatum when the ultimatum could be something she rejects? We're not going to, or we're going to X or Y, and that could actually isolate you from her and her from you, right? Mm-hmm. And that means that now the kids don't have that support, that eye over the shoulder, that involvement that they really need, whether, you know, the sibling wants to choose to live like this. And I think one of the questions that had come in prior to the call was, what about somebody who would rather be mistreated or abused than be alone? And there are people like that out there, and it's very hard to understand or to resonate with if that's not you. And I would say that when it's put down like that, most people don't resonate with that sentiment. I would rather be mistreated than be alone. There might be more people that, if they were actually in the situation, would feel that way, but most people don't consciously resonate with the idea that I'd rather be mistreated than be alone. But there are definitely people out there that is their core, their bottom line. And when that exists, there's not much we can do. That's the choice they make. But then the question becomes, but what about the kids? The kids now come along with your choice to be mistreated rather than be alone, and how is that affecting them? And that's something that might have to be confronted. But at the point, you know, where all the siblings are starting to know and the siblings are starting to talk with each other and strategize with each other, you know, that's a time and an opportunity to also confer with a professional. This is, you know, a lot of people don't think of that because they think she needs the help or he needs the help in a different kind of way. Like, why would we call a professional? But I've seen more and more that the siblings of, the friends of, the parents of are starting to say, we should get some guidance here. We don't want to push and push her away. We don't want to pull back because we're respecting her choices and she experiences that as no one's there for me, no one really cares. What's the balance? So it can be very hard to navigate. Ultimately, you guys figured out your sister fine and how to be there for her in that proper balance so that she could accept your help. But if anybody out there is sort of questioning, you know, do I jump this way or do I jump that way, you might want to discuss the particulars of that sibling and that situation with a professional before making a decision. Sometimes it's hard. You get this shocking information, this shock of cold water in your face, and it's hard to say, oh, but I'm not going to do anything about that until we can figure out how to talk it over with somebody. Most people want to jump right into the fray. And recognizing that this has been going on for a good long time and it could wait, as painful or difficult as that to think about, it could wait another whatever, until we get the proper guidance of what do you do here and what don't you do here is really an important piece. Now, you guys mentioned you all started talking to each other and conference calls, but I think you had told me previously that there was a point in the beginning where she had sort of been talking to one sibling that she had sworn to secrecy.
That's correct. So she had been confiding in one sibling, and like you said, told her not to tell because she herself felt that if everybody would know about it, that we would be putting pressure on her, and she obviously wasn't ready for that and wanted to try and work things out. But she needed somebody to tell, and she had that sibling. And ultimately, when we all started finding out about everything and discussing and finding out that, kind of pull all the information together, that everybody kind of maybe was hearing a little, not as much as this one sibling, but someone heard a piece over there, someone heard a piece over there. It definitely gave it the fuller picture. But, you know, in hindsight, I think that that sibling felt, you know, at the end of the day, that not knowing beforehand, but now knowing what she knows now, that it would have been beneficial for herself and for our sister to have shared that information in the beginning. And I just want to second what you said about going to for the siblings or the family to ask for professional help, how to proceed. We didn't do that.
Yeah.
We didn't think of that at the time, but definitely, and we, like you said, did ultimately figure it out, but it would have been, I think it would have been very, very beneficial.
Right. The reason that I brought up that sibling is because, in my experience, it's so common. Sometimes there's complete radio silence from the beginning. The person in trouble doesn't tell a soul from the beginning, and it's only when things are observed that things come out. But so many times I've heard this same story of there was one sibling, but they swore them to secrecy, and now it's years and years later, and so much more has been done and happened to her, and you know, and now things are coming out. And so for anyone who might be listening on the call and be that identified sibling who is being confided in but sworn to secrecy, do not keep the secret. Even if you feel like you can only talk to a professional who will keep it confidential, don't hold it alone. It's not, you know, we don't think of ourselves as in this way, so, you know, I don't mean to offend anybody with the analogy or with the comparison, but, you know, it's sort of like when we tell young children, you don't keep certain kind of secrets from your parents. Somebody tells you to keep that kind of secret, you know, whether it's abuse or something like that. Somebody tells you to keep that kind of secret, that's not a secret they can ask you to keep. And we don't think of ourselves as children. We're adults, and this is my sibling, and they need this from me, and they're telling me their life, their marriage depends on it. There are certain secrets that we shouldn't feel that we're obligated to keep. If you feel like, you know, maybe she's right, if I tell my siblings, they're going to all go, you know, marching over there, and it'll ruin her life. Okay, so reach out. Reach out to the Shalom Task Force hotline if you want to be completely anonymous and sort of keep the secret, but at least get some perspective. Don't hold it alone, because ultimately domestic violence festers in isolation. It's isolation and secrecy feeds it. It's what allows it to grow. And poking a little hole of light and awareness and education into that starts to sort of ease what's going on, lets there be possibilities. So no one should be holding this by themselves. You know, hopefully the women won't hold it by themselves, but if you're a sibling or family member or friend, get some perspective from somewhere. If you think that they might be right, that your other siblings or your parents will go over there and act rashly, and you're worried that maybe it is salvageable, but if my father hears this, it's over. Okay, so it's not your father you go to, but it's not keeping it to yourself. That's just a, you know, a killer for the situation. And the other thing I wanted to bring up is sort of this notion or the differences between the kind of sibling you might be talking about. Almost always, if you're talking about a sibling who's in it and still in it, she's in some ways defensive of or hopeful that something will change or it will be different or he or she is not that bad or things are not going to stay like this, they'll get better, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But there's varying degrees of how resistant, of how aware, of how clear they are with themselves, what's okay and what's not okay. Some of that has to do with the person's own history, their own ability to imagine themselves alone or not. But there are some siblings where, you know, people will get together and say, this is not okay, and that's a huge relief for them to hear. It's not okay, and I have family members around. And then there's other siblings, other people, who somebody tries to come and say, like, what's going on? This is not okay. I'm noticing things, and it's, you know, and it's fine. What do you mean? Everything's great. Everything's amazing. Now, a lot of people go back and forth and back and forth. But when there's a totally shut down wall of everything's fine, I don't know what you're talking about, you're ridiculous, it can be extremely challenging. And the important thing at that point, when the sibling's not willing to see or hear or entertain, is to maintain a relationship, which can put a great strain on human beings. To maintain a relationship and to continue to try and be around the sibling and her family, because she's with her family now or he's with his family now, to continue to try and interact with them, because isolation, like I said before, isolation and secret is what helps foster abuse. But if the sibling sort of in their anger or frustration or disgust kind of can't stand to be around him, so now we don't look to have you around so much. You're choosing this, so fine, but I don't want to be around this. When family members respond that way, they're kind of doing half of his job already, because he doesn't have to work so hard to isolate her and keep her in this bubble of abuse, because the family members are pushing it along because of their own discomfort or their own disgust in being around him or his behavior. Was that ever a challenge for you guys to sort of maintain relationship and interaction? Seeing what you see and knowing what you knew?
Yes. I'll say yes. Straight
on. Oh, you're human. Hooray.
It was very difficult. It came to the point where, you know, we would always spend Shabbos meals together, and then, you know, I said, okay, I don't know if I can do this anymore. And then there was a lot of that guilt. Am I supposed to be there? Am I not? What about my husband and what's going to, you know, in our relationship and spending time, and if he's uncomfortable, do I, you know, where do I go with this? And a part of me also, and very naively, but thought, you know, if I'm, you know, if she sees that we don't want to be around him, maybe that's going to cause her or push her to think about her situation.
Right.
Which
there
obviously
definitely
was
very, a lot of frustrations along those lines, like where you would, like, how could you keep on doing this? The good part is where you say, like, if you would get frustrated and say, you know, I can't be around this right now, was that there always seemed to be, at least I think for in our situation, another sibling who could almost pick up the slack. So you're upset with me right now. You know, we're not going to talk for a little bit, but there's someone else who's saying, once we're all involved, that there's someone else that you can talk to.
Right, or have around, or, yeah. But if you're the only one, or there's only two of you, and you're both sort of frustrated and disgusted by him, with him, and with her for you know,
you want to protect your own
continuing family with this, it's a big drain. And you know, getting some support, and that doesn't necessarily even mean, you know, professional support. When you have your guidance, you have your guidance, but getting support for doing this so that you can continue to do this, to be there, to be an address, and checking in again, like I said, with the professional and seeing, does this make sense? You know, one of the questions that was running in is like, am I facilitating? Am I, you know, sort
enabling.
Of enabling this
mm-hmm.
marriage by being so good to her? And that's a tricky one. There are times where I do feel that there's sort of this, you know, community codependence to her codependence. So she's being, you know, in the situation where the abuse comes out of, or there's abusive behavior, which is not the same thing as domestic abuse, but there's abusive behavior connected with an addiction. And then the spouse is codependent to the addiction, and then the family members who are sort of helping and supporting her, because Nebuch, sort of become codependent to her codependence. But that's really in a situation where there's an addiction that's at the core. When there's domestic violence that's at the core of the behavior, of the abusive behavior, it's not a situation of codependence. She's caught in a different way. Whatever her own individual issues are with, you know, sort of being stuck there, and the fear and the repercussions and all the things that he would terrorize her with, should she think about getting out of that situation. What I would say for the family members that are feeling like, are we enabling this, is it might feel like that, but I don't think you make ultimatums in the ultimatum kind of sense ever. Not in the sense of, you better leave him or. You can do what you guys were contemplating, which is, I understand that this, you know, you've decided this is okay for you, but we can't watch this happen to the children. We're going to have to do something about that. That's not an ultimatum of, we're now going to be as coercive as he is, right? You better leave him. It's a different message. You got to do what you got to do, but we got to do what we got to do.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because I think there was at one point where it was like, you know, you're complaining that he's being controlling. You guys are also telling me what to do.
Right,
yeah.
Which is the big trap. Because there really is no difference. If I mean your taiva, and I'm just trying to be a good sibling, and I'm just, you know, trying to rescue you, but I'm doing it in a way that's pushing you and pulling you, it doesn't really feel different to the person at that point from him. Not functionally, not in the process of it. Maybe nobody's hitting her, and in the marriage she's being, or he's being hit, but that you have to, you got to, you aren't allowed to, is really very similar in dynamic. It's very different to sort of have the stance of, I can't make you, but you can't make me, not protect your children. You can't make me, you know, give you money for X and Y and Z that I know you really allow him to use for. I can't do that knowing what's going on. In terms of the one-on-one interactions, I always use this analogy for the friends, family members, helpers who are working with somebody who's being abused, who is coming and who is talking about the abuse and is telling these things. And then that person becomes sort of the repository. Here she comes and sort of dumps all the bad stuff, and I, as the sister or whatever, am left distressed and horrified. And somehow off she goes, relieved and fine. And I'm sitting here with this stuff. And further, I'll try and show her how bad this is, or I'll tell her this can't go on, and or I think I'm validating how bad it is and how this is, you can't be treated like this, and this is, and I get argued back with. You came to complain to me. I'm telling you this is horrible, and now you're telling me it's not so bad. What? So here's the analogy. I was once reading a book, and it was about a hostage negotiator, first-person hostage negotiator. And the hostage negotiator is talking about, you know, how when the kidnapper is making their demands and they're saying, you know, I need this, I want $1 million, and then a plane to wherever is, there's no extradition, and, you know, I think I'm just going to kill the five-year-old. He is so annoying. But the hostage negotiator cannot jump in and go, no, you can't do that. Because in this part of the analogy, the kidnapper is looking for that power play. And if the hostage negotiator gives him the power play, he's only going to do more of this because that's what they're looking for. But you can't say nothing. The guy's saying he's going to kill the five-year-old. You can't say nothing. That's morally repugnant. And that there's this middle ground where you say something, but it's not an emotional, invested, high-pitched something. It's a something of, you know, I don't want you to do that. And here, that applies perfectly. Not necessarily for the same reason. It isn't a power play. But the woman or the man in that situation usually has ambivalence. As much as they might argue that it's not so bad and it's not so terrible and he really wants to change and he really wants to be different and he promised next time and I think he means it this time. And there really is ambivalence. But ambivalence is uncomfortable, especially if one side of the ambivalence means I might have to do something different. I might have to make a demand. I might have to leave. I might have to something. If I can let go of that part of the ambivalence, if I can get rid of it, then I can stay exactly where I am. And it's much easier to stay the same than to change anything. So I'm going to dump this on you. You're going to get one side of the argument. You're going to take that side of the argument that it's terrible and horrible, and then I could just stay with it's really not so bad, it's really not so bad. And that as a friend or as a family member, when this person comes a-knocking with what's happened and what he did, and you stay with, I wouldn't be able to tolerate that. I can't imagine, you know, being in a marriage where I'm treated like that. And not allowing the person to co-opt you and sort of get you to take that side of the argument that they want to get rid of. But to leave them with it and leave them with their ambivalence and leave them with both parts of this. It's not a fast process, but it's the best process to get them to a place where they're really disturbed by his behavior enough to actually do something rather than us on the other side do the disturbed ones where we have no power to do anything about her marriage or his marriage. Can't do anything. But I can leave him with his ambivalence. I could leave her with her ambivalence that starts to make her uncomfortable by not arguing how bad it is. And the impulse to do it is tremendous.
Oh, yeah.
And it takes superhuman strength or a lot of support not to do it. But it taking the bait just means they, you know, you could probably, if you think about it, you'll find times where here she came all upset, got you all upset, and all of a sudden she's calm. Like, what just happened?
Right, and she leaves and goes home, and then we can't sleep for that whole day.
Exactly. What just happened? Wasn't she upset? Why is she going home fine?
And then you call up your other sibling and say, you just had this whole conversation. I can't believe it.
But it's
and how
so,
did
it's
she justify this now? And she was,
yeah.
She sounded like she was so much better, and now she's back to planning a vacation with him, like what, you know, it could be crazy making, but that's what's going on.
And it's
she
not
comes
even
in with the end of the
level.
Doesn't want it, dumps it on you, and goes off. it's not a conscious process. Nobody's being, you know, mean or nasty or you know, mindful of this. But that's the dynamic that's going on.
Wow.
And people, siblings, friends, parents who stop taking the bait see a usually, nothing's 100%, usually in this kind of situation where she's anyway, you know, confiding and sometimes distressed, we'll see a huge shift over time, but we'll see a huge shift when they stop taking the feelings and leave her or him with the feelings. It's very hard, and especially if you've been taking the feelings for a while, when you stop, there'll be a lot of very provocative statements and stories to try and get you back in your role of keeper of the horror. So just warning everyone out there, it's not an easy thing to shift this dynamic, but it's a really crucial thing to shift this dynamic and not to allow it into your lap. In a very kind way. Not, I don't want to hear this anymore, but I don't know how you do it. I couldn't. No, he's not so bad, whatever. Okay. I'm just saying, like, I couldn't deal with that, but if it's not so bad to you, and allow that to kind of sit there. Not so bad to you. Oh, come on. It is so bad to them. That's why they came crying in the first place.
Right.
Now, one of the things we did do...
Yeah, go ahead.
You said we didn't go to professional, but what we did do is try to educate ourselves about this whole topic and reading books, and including your book, which was very helpful. And
yeah.
I'm just wondering how you balance, like, what you just said, like, I wouldn't let that happen to me, or I wouldn't stay in such a marriage, with the knowledge now, I think, the understanding that this is something that could happen to anyone. It's not like a personality that causes you to become a victim.
Right. No, but I wouldn't say I wouldn't stay in such a marriage. I wouldn't be okay with something like that. When they're coming to you and what they're looking for is for you to be horrified so they can say it wasn't so bad, that you stop at that point and you say, I wouldn't be okay with that. Not I would get out what's wrong with you, or I wouldn't tolerate that what's with you. I wouldn't be okay with that. So that you're allowing the possibility for them to sit with, are they really okay with this? We're not up to the doing stage. We need them to own their feelings and not dump them off on somebody. Because as soon as you say, what? They say, no, it's not so bad.
Yeah.
And if you don't say, what? You say, I wouldn't be okay with that. Do they really go to, well, I'm fine with it. Oh, okay.
No.
Right. They don't.
No.
They came
to
you about it in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
That was the point.
That's amazing.
But it takes a lot of talking to yourself and maybe talking to other people to kind of be able to stay in that non-activated, not taking the bait, not jumping place. But this isn't about staying or not staying. We're not up to action. We're up to feeling. They have to own their feelings to be able to do anything different than they've done till now. So it's really about, I don't think I could be okay with that. And just sitting, not arguing, not showing, not telling, just sitting. Because that makes them sit with it. Does that answer your question?
That definitely, yes.
Okay. Because I think a lot of people, and it's you know, what I noticed in the questions coming in were a lot of, isn't it time then to, and don't I tell them they have to, you know, a lot of that. And that's just our natural inclination. It's coming from a good place.
Care about
but it's our natural reaction to hearing such horrible, traumatizing, activating information. You know, it's traumatic to hear these things happening to somebody that you love.
Yeah.
And we know that in trauma, we have either a fight or flight response. well, if it's traumatic to me to hear that my sibling is being mistreated or to witness whatever kind of mistreatment to her children certainly, that's traumatic. So I'm going to also go either into fight or flight mode. And I think that's where a lot of the comments of, don't you have to, and she has to, and I got to get him to, you know, that's the fight mode. The flight mode is when, you know, I don't know, I don't think, you know, maybe we're overreacting. Maybe, you know, well, you can't tolerate it and you got to run from the material. It's a very natural reaction, and sort of being aware that I'm having this reaction and getting myself back down to equilibrium so that I can do what I really need to do to be helpful instead of what I am knee-jerk reacting to doing, thinking that'll be helpful, because as you know, and I would like you to emphasize to everyone, you know, fighting with her to see reality is not usually successful.
No, it's not, because she's obviously, if she's living like this for so long, she's already created a different way to see reality.
Right.
She's already looking at things differently, because if she saw it the way we saw it,
and
it would be different.
It definitely because of when, you know, when we back off and say that ultimately this is going to have to be her decision when she's ready, it obviously took longer than we would have wanted. But then but then when the decision is made, I think it's
so much, powerful.
Yeah, much more powerful.
Right. Right. And I've, you know, seen, unfortunately, the times where people were, you know, sort of not literally but figuratively sort of picked up and hustled out of their relationship. And, you know, you really can't divorce somebody for somebody else. And so then they go back and then they feel even more stuck than they felt before, because here were all these people and they were really helping me and they told me so and, you know, this, that, and the other thing, and, you know, they're never going to want to help me again now when I've gone back and I've realized, oh, my gosh, what did I do? Or, oh, my gosh, he didn't really change. Or, oh, my gosh, all the promises he made are not reality. And but I sort of, you know, just, I don't know what the word is, you know, spit in the face of my help, and so how can I go back to them? So letting it be their decision, even though it can take a long time, is really kind of crucial. Because otherwise it doesn't work.
Another question I have, I guess it ties in a little bit to what you were saying about that story with the kidnapping.
Mm-hmm.
I'd witnessed something right in front of me, and I want to stand up and speak up and say that that's not okay. But I know that I'm going to be leaving after I'm done with my little speech. And
right.
I'm worried that I'm going to make the situation worse after I leave. Any anger directed at me is now going to, or, you know, that I cause is going to be let out on my sister.
Right. Which is why, you know, trying to say it to her in a private moment, this is what happened. We were all there, or I was there. I know you were there too. I'm really concerned about you. This is, it's just not okay behavior. I'm not really sure what's going on or how I can be helpful to you, but know that, you know, you have support and you have people who care about you, and I know you can't possibly think that what just happened was okay. There just isn't an excuse for that kind of behavior. Yeah, because
can
often there's some, well, he painted me into a corner, she painted me into a corner, and so I had to behave that way. No, nobody has to behave that way. But you're right, if you stand up and make a proclamation in front of him to her, that could be putting her, you know, in the way of a tirade by him later. It's why people don't recommend couples counseling for couples where there's domestic abuse, because either she'll just lie her way through it, or she'll be lulled into this false sense of security that I can say what's going on, or I can be honest about what's happening, and then she goes home with him and he's furious.
Okay.
So, you know, that's why it's not really indicated in cases of abuse.
What about saying something to him? I think that's what Yisrael was saying. What if he's in public or in front of you, he's behaving in an abusive manner, and you call him out on his behavior in front of her?
Well, I think calling him out on his behavior in any forum seems like a bracha levatala. Like, really? What's that going to do? I mean, maybe you have some sort of knowledge that if he knows you noticed it, then that will have some sort of, you know, impact on his desire not to ever do it again. But the guy's already up to the point where he's willing to do it in public, in front of you at least. He probably doesn't care what you have to say to him about it. So it probably can only, like you said, enrage him. And if anything's going to have an impact, it's saying to her, like, hello, how are you? I'm not really sure how you're okay with this. Mm-hmm. This is really just not okay behavior. It's not okay behavior, and you got to da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But
right.
Do you know that this just does not belong in a marriage? For any, like, there's just no circumstance or anything you can point to that says that this is okay.
So making sure to have
then
that conversation.
Let him. Why am I going to listen?
That's true.
Or
you
I
know?
Know, also part of it is, you know, if he's behaving in a certain way and you say that that's not okay, maybe that in some way would give her support so she sees, like, we don't stand for that.
Well,
but then I guess it depends.
Again, doing that privately.
Right.
You know, has the benefits of what you're saying without the risk that you're angering him, but he's not going to be angry at you.
Right. No, he won't. That's an important piece to go back after.
Right.
And bring up. Because it's always like a concern. Do I open my mouth now? Do I keep my mouth shut? Like, what is she learning from me?
Right.
I'm saying the same thing she's saying, but I'm not doing anything. So what does that mean about the situation? But if I follow up privately, then I'm acknowledging
that
what happened
is
not okay.
If he can do it in front of us and all of us are silent, then yeah, then that's a really bad message to her that, yeah. But there's a difference between being completely silent and being silent in front of him because you don't want her to get it.
Right.
And you could even say that to her. I didn't want to say anything at the time because I knew that he couldn't, when he would be angry and embarrassed, he wouldn't let it out on me. He would probably let it out on you, which is why I didn't say anything in the moment. But I did need to make sure you understand that us siblings staying silent when he does X or Y or Z is not an endorsement or in any way mean we're okay. We need you to know that none of us think this belongs in a marriage. It's not so bad. Okay, I guess you get to make that choice. I can't imagine how that fits into anyone's conception of marriage. I don't know. Because again, you know, you want to toe that line where you're not taking away the feelings, but you're not saying nothing. You can't make her, you know, if she starts being defensive, it's not so bad, it wasn't so bad, oh, I didn't take it like that, it wasn't, whatever. You don't want to get more forceful. You want to back. You know, it's like if somebody's leaning against you to try and, you know, start a fight and you take a step back, there's no fight. It's over. But she starts with the defensiveness, and you take a step back and say, okay, I had to say something because I didn't want you to think that I thought that was okay treatment of my sister. If you're okay being treated like that, I don't know what to say. But I needed to come make the point, even though I didn't want to make the point in the moment because I knew he'd be angry and then he'd take it out on you. So it's that statement, but without the pushiness, without the emotionality, without the trying to get her to see, without the taking, you know, taking the feelings and being the distressed one, but also not being completely silent. There's a middle ground, which is really important in this role, when someone has this role in the abused person's life.
which is why it would have been so helpful had we sought professional guidance. Because we
Well, ultimately, you guys, you know, figured it out. So maybe you want to share with everybody, you know, what you figured out and how you figured it out and what happened. Because, you know,
you got her to get it.
So obviously you have what to share with other people in this scenario.
Well, I think one of the main things was the patience. And that,
the what?
Some of the things that that you were spoken about, we were able to do eventually, letting her know that she had that support, and when she was ready, you know, we would be there for her, and continuing to point out some of the issues that she had. Obviously, like the way you said to say it, sounds like something definitely would work, but like you really have to practice before you get in that situation so you can say it right.
Uh-huh.
And you know, also I think one of the, and ultimately it was that she was strong enough to take the step that she needed to do. So I guess we gave her the support to be able to come to that, you know, very brave decision. But she was able to do it. And a big catalyst, I guess, was when she was able to see that it wasn't her problem. It was his problem.
Right. Yeah. People who are abusive are very, very good at, you know, working on their spouse to believe that it's them, that it's the spouse and not them, that their behavior is only a reaction to something that the spouse did or something that the spouse didn't do. They're very, very good for, you know, and it works on sort of the other spouse's correct understanding of what is a healthy marriage. Because a healthy marriage is when each spouse thinks it's their job, it's their place to be taking care of the other. And then if both spouses think that that is their obligation to be thinking about and caring for their spouse, then both people are getting cared for from a caring position. Now, if you have one spouse who thinks your job is to take care of me, that's true, and then my job is also to take care of me, that we would call sort of a dysfunctional marriage. I'm taking care of you, and you're taking care of you. And then if you have a situation where I think I'm supposed to be taking care of you, and you think you're supposed to be ruling over me, and taking advantage of that to control me, then we've moved into domestic violence. Not that it's a continuum, but those are sort of on one foot, because that's not really the focus of the call, but on one foot, those are sort of the discrete positions. Now, if I think my job is to take care of you, and you use that to tell me how I'm not doing a good enough job, and therefore I behave like that, or therefore I had to talk to you like that, it's very hard to get out of the mindset of what I know to be true about how a spouse is supposed to treat their spouse, especially because I'm right. It is how I'm supposed to treat my spouse, to care for them and to be worried about them and to be concerned with what they're distressed with. And if nobody's educated me that, yeah, but he's supposed to be doing the same thing or she's supposed to be doing the same thing, and when instead of doing that same thing, they're using it in this twisted, distorted way, then you got to let go of your role or you're going to get swallowed whole. If no one's told me that, then I just keep trying to be that good spouse. And you keep telling me how the reason I had to cut you off from money is because you weren't being a good enough spouse. So I keep trying to be a good enough spouse. And it could take a very long time for the person to say, hey, wait a minute. I'm not being that bad of a spouse.
Mm-hmm.
It can't only be me who's working. It could take a very long time to kind of step out and break out of that confusion, because I'm not thinking wrong, technically speaking. I'm not thinking the wrong things when I'm trying to please you. But I'm thinking the wrong things for the situation. But the end of that sentence is not something that people are always taught about.
I should add a very important thing that we did was to try and educate ourselves when, you know, we kind of realized that this is the situation and we're trying things that make sense to us. And we, you know, started reading, like we said, read your book and Lundy Bancroft with a book that really, to help us understand what was going on,
right.
was a very, very big, a big help.
Yeah.
To try to understand what she was going through.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you, how long was it from when the siblings, you know, had a real awareness and started conference calling amongst themselves until ultimately something changed for your sister and in the relationship until she did something? How long did that take?
I kind of get confused on the whole timeline. Nahama, do you have a better idea? Off the top of my head, it feels like, I want to say, like 2 years.
Yeah. I would agree with that. And then at the end of that, and it was 2 years, but it was a lot of back and forth where we thought, oh, she's really going to do something now. And then it fell flat.
Mm-hmm.
And then, oh, now she's really going to do something, and it fell flat. And ultimately, it was after we were at a family. The whole family was together for something,
mm-hmm.
or the majority of the family, a bunch of families, and he was acting out where everybody could see, and he was mistreating everybody, and that really shook her because she was now watching it happen, not in her home with her and her kids where somehow she was able to shut down from that, but she was watching him behave in this way toward everybody, and my guess is on his end he must have felt that his end was coming because, you know, he stopped putting on that show of being Mr. Perfect. And after that, it was just a couple months from that particular event.
I don't think that happened. It didn't happen by itself. It happened because she'd slowly, steadily
mm-hmm.
been moving towards this point.
Right. So that when you were all together, she was seeing him through your guys' eyes,
yeah.
not just her eyes.
And then, like Nahama said, that there's definitely the frustration of two steps forward, one step back, and sometimes one step forward and two steps back.
Yeah.
It's very hard
yeah.
to.
But just it just reiterates the point of how important and why it's important to maintain the relationship. That she can never see him through your eyes if the family members are not around because everyone's just, you know, fed up and disgusted and, you know, somebody asked the question, well, what happens if you don't live near the person? What if they've moved away from where her family is to where his family is or to, you know, the other end of the world, stop. You know, they took a job, they're whatever. It makes it much more complicated. It doesn't mean you shouldn't reach out to a professional to brainstorm what are possible avenues in, what are possible ways you want to handle it when she comes to visit, if she comes to visit, and ways you don't want to handle it when she comes to visit and if she comes to visit. Because there are sometimes creative things that you could come up with when you brainstorm and when you hear more details. There isn't a pat answer. Oh, when somebody lives in another country, then the way to go is to send a cake once a month. No, there isn't like a pat answer, but depending on the relationships and the people you know she has in her life or the people you don't know she has, there could be some sort of creative something that keeps the relationship going enough so that if she comes to a point where she's ready to reach out, things aren't totally cut, but still open and available. So that's just, you know, you guys were, or she was fortunate enough to have that built in right there and to have siblings who were committed enough to keep it up even through their own difficulties with it, because it is a big drain on the people around her as well. But for people who don't have that because they're far away from their sibling, it doesn't mean that there's nothing to do, but it also doesn't mean there's like something specific I could tell on a general call that everyone could do.
Lisa?
Yeah.
Okay, we got lots of questions that came in. No, there's definitely not enough time to address all of them. But
right.
One question came in with from the children. They're already teenage children,
yeah.
And they're watching this, and they want it to end. Can they do something? Or can they work with their aunts and uncles to do something?
I think it's a great idea for children not to do it alone, and to brainstorm with their resources, to, if they're the ones listening on the call, to make sure their resources know not to rush in a activated, unplanned way, because you can make things worse like that. You know, we had a story a million years ago about parents who were alerted to some abuse going on in their daughter's home, and they had this big confrontation, and the spouse, you know, said they were so sorry, and not soon after, you know, got a job in a different country and moved the family away. So you definitely want to be very well thought out and very well planned out, and make sure you're going to people who have, you know, the temperament to sort of think and plan like this family did, and talk and get advice and make a plan in that way. But sometimes, depending on the woman, you know, but it definitely can be helpful to her to have her own kids, because often the women are there for the sake of the children, they're there for the sake of the children, they're there for the sake of the children, and then the children come and say, "Ma, what are you doing?" And that can really be the impetus for her to sort of look at things differently. This is not for the sake of the children. The children are telling me they're suffering. Oh, wait a minute. So it can be very powerful, but they definitely should have some adults involved as well.
And can we flip it the other way, that the relatives bring in their teenage children and tell the teenage children to tell their parents, "What are you doing?"
Well, you know, again, let's investigate who, what, where, you know, what are the particulars? I don't think you send children in to pit themselves who are not looking to do that, because ultimately, you know, there are some children that are furious at the mom, even though it's the dad, let's say, in that situation, the dad's the one that's abusive. There are kids that are with their mom, and then there are kids that are angry with their mom. Because even though she's the one that's being abused, they see her as the healthy one. Why aren't you doing anything? Why aren't you doing anything? Why aren't you doing anything? So if it's not the kids that are coming and saying, "We want to do something," you don't know where the kids are standing. You have to go slowly. You have to investigate. You have to talk to the kids. What's going on? How are you? What's up? What, you know, is everything okay? Can we do something? You know, you don't know who you're dealing with until you do a little bit more investigating, or what the emotions are there. And you don't want to put kids in the position of having to be in the middle of that. If nothing's going to happen and you just told the kids to go say something and mom goes running to dad to say, "You know what the kid said?" And now they got to live there. Like, you got to be very careful.
Thank you. And one final question,
well,
even though we have, go ahead.
I was just going to say that the kids going living in such a house could be traumatized as well.
Right. You don't put things on them that they're not asking to be a part of, you know, without a lot of, you know, very careful, you know, exploration.
Okay, there were a lot of powerful questions, and we will have to address them in some way.
Maybe some email format or something, I don't know.
Yeah, we'll figure out how to address them, because there are a lot of powerful unanswered and painful question. But the final question I want to ask for tonight is, what to do when family members who are making these decisions don't really understand what abuse is anyway, and so amongst the family there's such a spectrum of what to do?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that this family did really well was they got themselves educated. You know, you can't make people get themselves better educated if they've decided they know everything. But if you're dealing with people who really want to do best, and you say, you know, let's get educated so we can be on the same page, then obviously that will only be helpful, because then if they're all on the same page, they can act together and have sort of that unity of resources for the situation. There's some of the siblings, let's say, in a situation who are saying, no, we know. You know, what can you do? You can't stop them from having that attitude. You got to hope that you can maybe convince them to agree to get educated together.
if I could just add real quick, we did have disagreements between ourselves, but I think we tried very hard that when we would present something to our sister, that that would be just one message. So we'd argue it out, we'd have, like you said, across the spectrum, because we did have different ideas, we'd have to come to some kind of decision before we talked to her, so that she didn't have to hear all that
right.
argument going on. And get
right. Excellent. That's an excellent point.
Okay, like I said, Dvorah again, like I said, there's many more questions, and we will work out a way to get the answers to you. We'll have to figure it out, whether it's a series of articles, another call, or whatever, because these are really important questions. I want to thank everyone for joining us tonight. Follow up on our website, adayad.org. It will also be on the Crown Heights Community Council's website. It will also probably be a COL article as well. Follow us on Facebook for the next events, conference calls. And if you have any ideas or suggestions or comments about this call or what else we can do to help make a crack at domestic abuse, please email us at info@adayad.org. That's adayad.org. Or if you want to send it anonymously, you can use the anonymous form that was on the ad for this event, which is adayad.org/ask-anonymous-question. So once again, thank you, Lisa, thank you, Nechama, and thank you, Yisrael, for really bringing out some very important points. And we don't want to leave anyone hanging with their questions, so please send in any other questions, and we will get back to you. If you send it an anonymous question, I'm the only one who reads it, and will forward it to someone who can help you. So while it's anonymous, you have the option to add your name as well so we can get the answer back to you. Once again,
great.
Thank you all for joining us. And anyone have any final thoughts?
No, this was a great forum. Thanks, you guys. It really added a lot to have people who've been through this parsha.
Thank you so much for organizing it, Dvorah. And
yes.
Lisa, your advice was great.
Yeah, thank you so much. This is so important.
Thank you all. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.